Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us in the first part of the show is Rebecca Waters of the Wolverine Foundation. And she's here to talk about the plans to reintroduce wolverines to the state of Colorado. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining Claire and myself on This Green Earth.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about my favorite animal.
Yeah,
Claire and I
have lots of questions about wolverines. They're an amazing animal. We'll get into that. First of all, how many animals have their own foundation? That's what I want to know. A Wolverine Foundation, when was that started? And what is the mission of the Wolverine Foundation?
Yeah, so in 1996, I think probably every single wolverine biologist in the world, and there weren't that many of them, got together. And these are people who were really interested in knowing more about this poorly understood and poorly researched animal. And they got together and decided that they wanted to have an organization that would be dedicated to fundraising for research and for advancing awareness or raising awareness of the species and its conservation needs. And so that was the beginning of the organization. It's a very small organization. And it's a non-advocacy based organization. It's primarily dedicated to working on research and interpreting the science for people who are interested in more science-based management for the animal. And I think in the decades since the organization has been founded, of course, the profile of the species has significantly increased, and to the point where there is an ESA listing in the United States and plans for reintroduction. So in that sense, the folks who were involved in those early stages had a long range vision and were pretty successful.
All right. Definition of terms, ESA listing. What is that?
Yes, sorry. Of course, people in the environmental world use so many acronyms, so much jargon. That is the Endangered Species Act. And in November of 2023, wolverines were placed on the Endangered Species Act with a threatened status. So they now have federal level protections.
Wow. And by threatened, what does that mean in terms of, let's say, numbers and locations, et cetera?
Yeah, wolverines were essentially extirpated from the lower 48 states by the early 20th century. And partially that was a result of overtrapping, and partially that was a result of poisoning of carcasses that were set out to try to eliminate wolves. So wolverines they're primarily scavengers. They have fantastic noses. And if you set out a carcass on a landscape, they're going to find it. And they exist at such low population densities that they are very capable of like having a significant population, negative population effect if enough wolverines get into these poison carcasses. So that we think that that's what happened. And they were knocked all the way back up into either northern Montana or all the way to Canada. And then in the second half of the 20th century, they were in a process of recolonization of former habitat. So they had experienced this population decline, and then they were still naturally quite rare. They're naturally quite rare ecologically too, which is an important point to emphasize. But because they were in this process of recolonization, their numbers were very low. And then during the sort of early stages of wolverine research in the United States, scientists started to see this very close link to cold, snowy environments and started to be able to articulate some aspects of that dependence on cold and snow. And that was the same point at which we were becoming more and more aware of the looming effects of climate change. And so the listing process is a very long process. It involved scientific research and then the federal government coming back multiple times and saying, we don't know enough about this animal to decide whether it's endangered or not. And through, I think it was two decades of back and forth, finally in 2023, there was enough science to show that, yes, there is going to be an effect from climate change on this species. And that is a threat that warrants protections under the Endangered Species Act. So the real issue with wolverines is climate change effects coming in the future. I mean, we're starting to experience them now, but for the species, the long-term impacts could be quite serious.
We'll get to more about climate change impacts, but...
Yeah, well, let's rewind just a little bit because I think it's very fascinating, this path to study wolverines, because like you said, there aren't a lot of scientists out there studying them. They are a very elusive creature. We know very little bit about them, and it's hard to kind of track that information. So maybe bringing it back to, how did you land into this field of study? And from what I understand, you're one of the few that actually has had quite a interesting encounter with a wolverine.
Yeah, so it's a bit of a long and convoluted story, but the short version is that I just really like mountain environments and I like wildlife, and I wanted to do wildlife work. And I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Mongolia, and I was an environmental volunteer, and I was doing work there on wildlife and wildlife research. And when I came back, I went to get my master's degree at the School of the Environment at Yale. And my summer research internship was in Wyoming. And I ended up, by happenstance, it wasn't what I was doing my research on, but going on a wolverine expedition with somebody who was working for the Absorca Beartooth Project, and needed somebody to go with him just as a safety measure. You're not really supposed to go out on your own on these research trips when you're working for the federal government or involved with anything that has federal funding. So I went out, and we were looking for, at that time they had wolverines that were collared, and you would download the collar information, and there would be these clusters of sites where wolverines were spending a bunch of time. And usually something interesting was going on. If you saw a wolverine going back to the same site multiple times, it meant either that there was a food source there, or maybe there was a den site. And so we wanted to go and look at this cluster of locations that had been downloaded from the collar. And it was this really ambitious expedition. We had 2 days to go 42 miles. I didn't really understand fully what I was getting into. I just said I would do it because it sounded really cool. And the night that we were out, the first night, there was a wolverine that actually came into our campsite.
Whoa.
And just circled the campsite for, like, I don't know, 15 minutes. And we were so excited and, like, so giddy and just watching this animal and so curious about what it was doing. And at the same time, it was also really curious about us and watching what we were doing and just kind of circling around and looking at us and going to a different vantage point and cocking its head and sort of being like, well, what are these things doing up here in my habitat? And I can't really describe without sounding a little bit goofy, you know, why that was so intriguing to me, but I was just hooked. And it also turned out that there was an unstudied population of wolverines in Mongolia. And I think that that was really the key thing for me, because I had wanted to go back there and continue to do wildlife research there. And so that was how I got drawn in, was just this encounter with this wolverine on a mountaintop in Wyoming in 2006, summer of 2006. And that was, from there on out, that's what I was doing.
It just took one.
You just won. Yep.
You had me. Yeah.
But they're so elusive and fascinating that I'm sure that encounter was quite intriguing.
It was, especially because the whole time before we went, the person I was hiking in with, who was working on this project, was like, there's no way we're going to actually see this wolverine. I just want you to be prepared. You know, we're not going up there to see the wolverine. We will not see the wolverine. There are wolverine biologists who work in the field for 20 years and they never see a wild wolverine. And then the wolverine came right into our camp. And so it did feel very, like, exciting and kind of special and just electrifying.
In changing your path in life. So then you begin to study these animals. I think what's fascinating about them not only is the ground that they cover, from what I understand, they have quite a large territory and they're very territorial, but also that it can be quite ferocious. Yes?
Yeah. So to your first point, they are extremely mobile. They go all the time. So they establish territories when they're adults, and they defend those territories against all other wolverines of the same sex. So a female wolverine will exclude other female wolverines. A male wolverine will exclude other male wolverines, unless they are the offspring of those adult wolverines. Those guys are permitted to stay in their parents' territories for up to 18 months, and then they leave. But you have these adult reproductive animals that are patrolling territories that for the male, you know, can be up to 1,000 square kilometers, or, you know, a little bit bigger, like 500 square miles. And then the females, you know, up to 300 square miles. So just these huge territories for this relatively small weasel. And then for the young animals, when they're in search of a new territory, they can go for hundreds and hundreds of miles. They cover a lot of ground. I mean, most famously, of course, M56, who I tracked off of Togatee Pass in December, in Wyoming, in December of 2008, and who then went to Colorado, and after hanging out in Colorado for several years, went to North Dakota. So, you know, they have this capacity to just go endlessly, and that's part of what's really interesting about them. So that's the mobility part and the territorial part. And then to your point about their reputation, yes, they have a reputation for being ferocious, for and also for being extremely goofy. So if you look at a lot of the sort of stories from indigenous nations around the world, wolverines are seen as these kind of clown figures or trickster figures. But in the West, in European stories, they tend to have a reputation for being extremely gluttonous, so they'll eat anything, and also just berserker crazy.
Yeah.
And I think that the berserker crazy thing, I just want to point out, because I do feel like it's a little bit unfair, because almost all of that comes from encounters with wolverines in a trapping context. And if you're in a trap and backed into a corner, probably regardless of what species you are, you're going to be a little bit aggressive towards whoever has you in that trap. And wolverines just have the capacity to come off as exceptionally kind of just crazy and aggressive in that context. But it's important to remember that that's the context. They're right. Also a little bit bold. So like that wolverine who came into our camp, I think we would expect a lot of species to just run away, but this guy was just curious about us, and he came towards us instead of running off. And I think that that's another thing that people find very disconcerting. Like, why is this animal coming towards me instead of running away? It's at most 30 or 40 pound animal, and I'm bigger than it is. And what is it doing? Why is it running at me? Sometimes that's curiosity and not aggression.
Right.
And they will take down an animal three times their size as well, correct?
Yeah, so in Scandinavia, where there are a lot of wolverines that overlap with domestic reindeer herders, the reindeer herders really, really do not like wolverines that much, because they take down domestic reindeer pretty regularly. And then we have reports of a 30-pound, 35-pound female wolverine in Alaska taking down a full-grown moose. But again, wow. In these situations, and this is part of the cold and snow piece, those ungulates, those you know, deer species, they have these like long, thin legs that get stranded in snow. They can't move very effectively. And wolverines have these big, flat feet. They walk with their heels down like humans and like bears. And so essentially they have these big snowshoe feet where they can kind of float on top of the snow and maneuver much more effectively. And it's that that gives them the advantage. Is if the animals were not stranded or otherwise sort of made less strong by the snow, I don't think a wolverine could take down an animal of that size if it could fully run away with no problem.
But they're part of the weasel family.
They are the largest land-dwelling member of the weasel family. Sea otters are the only larger weasel. Weasels in general do have that sort of outsized ferocious reputation. I've had smaller weasels run at me, and honestly, that's even more disconcerting than having the wolverine come towards you, because those little weasels, like short-tailed weasels or least weasels, they're tiny, tiny, and I've still had them come at me instead of run away. Got some great photographs, but was also extremely confused about what this tiny animal thought it was doing. So I think it is a characteristic of the weasel family to just be very, very forthright and forward in that way.
We're speaking with Rebecca Waters. She's the former executive director of the Wolverine Foundation. Of course, we're talking all about wolverines. And most importantly, their planned reintroduction into Colorado. So we don't have a lot of time. So I want to understand, first of all, Are there Wolverines in Colorado right now?
As far as we know, no, there are not. And I think it's important. So there are a couple of confounding things with Wolverines, and I'll try to be very brief with this. But, you know, Wolverines can go anywhere, as we said. So you had a Wolverine who showed up in Colorado, but that doesn't mean that Wolverines were in Colorado because there was no reproductive population there. So the benchmark is there a reproductive population in a given location, not just a solitary animal or one or two animals? And so the answer for that in Colorado currently is no. There is no documented reproductive population there.
Okay, so what are the plans to reintroduce Wolverines to Colorado?
There was a bill that was recently passed, and they are going to move forward on that starting in the coming fiscal year, which is July. And there are plans to put 20 to 30, 30 Wolverines on the ground there pretty soon, and then try to acclimate them and see what happens.
So by on the ground, you mean certain locations in Colorado?
Yeah, they have a particular plan to put them in a, I think it's a rehabilitation location, and they will feed them in those locations so that they are accustomed to being there. Wolverines are pretty, like, if they get food in a certain spot, they'll stick around and revisit that spot to see if there's more food. And we see that when we live trap them for collaring. And so they will be habituated and acclimated to that location, and then they will let them out of those acclimation areas, and then the Wolverines will be able to go and establish their own territories, hopefully stick around.
What benefits do Wolverines provide to an ecosystem? Meaning, I guess, if I was an animal and I heard that Wolverines are coming back to the neighborhood, which animals would be nervous about that, and which ones would say, oh, that's good?
Yeah, I was gonna say, it depends on which animal you are, really. Yeah. I think anything that is small enough for a Wolverine to effectively hunt would be a little bit nervous. They do hunt things like pikas, you know, squirrels, ground squirrels, marmots. Oh, if I was a marmot, I would be very, very worried, because I know from Mongolia that they dig hibernating marmots out of their dens and eat them. So those are the animals I think would be worried. Maybe if you're a mountain goat or a mountain sheep, you might be a little worried, but you're probably more likely to get scavenged after you get avalanched off of a cliff. So
I was just wondering, though, Wolverines sound like they're an apex predator. So, you know, what overall benefit to an ecosystem do they provide, since, you know, everything is linked in that way?
Yeah, I often get this question, and they're actually more scavengers than they are predators. They're capable of killing these animals, but what we see far more frequently is that they just scavenge off of carcasses that are under the snow. And so I think the benefit, I'm a little bit reluctant to try to answer that question, because I think the benefit is just that they're there and they exist, and, you know, they are playing a role, maybe cleaning up the ecosystem as scavengers, but I don't know if I'd want to put like a mechanistic relationship or like a defined value relationship on it in quite that way, because we don't necessarily know all the functions that they serve.
But that would be something that could be explored and investigated and monitored, I guess.
I think that that's one of the biggest benefits of this reintroduction. It's extremely hard to study the species. It's extremely hard to get the kind of funding that you need to carry out really long-term demographic and ecological studies. And we have a lot of data, more than we did, but we still are missing some really key pieces. And so the reintroduction is going to allow for a really good look at how these animals really do interact with their ecosystem, and how they reproduce, and what the population looks like in given conditions over time. So yeah, for sure.
That's where my curiosity lies too. Do we know the ratio of males to females, and what is that reproductive cycle for a Wolverine, and what does, do they have a family structure? How does that work between the male and the female?
So typically what you see, the male territory will typically overlap with one or two females. And they mate in the late summer, but like bears, they have a system of delayed implantation. So the female holds those fertilized eggs and in suspension until December. And then, depending on her body condition, some number of the eggs will either implant or not implant. So if she is in not great condition, evolution has created this mechanism where it says, well, this adult reproductive female is more important to the population than her hypothetical offspring. And so we want to preserve her until such a time as she can have babies that she can fully raise and nurse and that will live to adulthood. So she can have up to four kits, but typically what we see is that a female wolverine has two kits every other year, and they don't reproduce until they're about 3 or 4 years old. So they have a very low reproductive potential over their lifetime. The female will give birth in a snow den sometime between sort of early February to March. We say February 14th. So for people who want something to celebrate other than Valentine's Day on February 14th, Wolverine birthday,
I would love
to see that become a fully recognized holiday. And then the kits stay with their parents. Well, they stay in their parents' territories until they're ready to disperse. And that can be anywhere from a year to 18 months. And we do have some evidence that they sometimes follow their mom around once they're out of the den, and they sometimes follow their dad around. So it seems that there's some kind of family education system that's going on there. For it's a little bit anthropomorphic, but you know, they're figuring out from their parents, from observing their parents, like, okay, how do I survive in this kind of harsh, low productivity landscape? What do I need to know to be a successful wolverine?
So the male landscape will be interactive in the den and with the kits.
The male, that we have seen males visiting, we see this in the collar data. So we see males visiting the dens of the where the females are raising their kits or nursing their kits. We don't know exactly what is going on in those situations, but we do see them visiting. So we can speculate that maybe he's bringing her food, or maybe he's just checking out what's going on, but we don't know for sure.
And did we clarify, do we know the ratio of male to female that they're reintroducing?
They are reintroducing, there will be, I think it's 10 males and 20 females. So they're trying to keep that 2-to-1 ratio.
And what is the territory that they're releasing them? If they cover this wide spans and they're territorial and they will fight with each other, how vast is this reintroduction?
They're reintroducing them over all of the Colorado modeled habitat, which I think is like 20% of the modeled habitat for wolverines in the lower 48. So there's a substantial amount of space out there for them. But to give you a perspective, you know, the Teton Range in Wyoming, that range at full capacity could hold 4 adult wolverines and their offspring. So the territory size is also partially determined by how much prey and how much food exists inside the territory. So you'll see the territories get bigger if they're less productive, like if that landscape is less productive. So I think it's hard to predict exactly how the territorial establishment is going to happen in Colorado, because it's a little bit of a different ecosystem in terms of what's out there as a food base. So that's one of the things that I think is going to be very interesting to watch, is like how exactly does that happen?
They're adept mountaineers, right? They can mobilize across a mountain pretty well.
They are so adept. I mean, famously, there is a wolverine that was collared in a study in Glacier National Park who went up Mount Cleveland. It was like, I think, 4,500 feet of elevation gain in like 90 minutes. And there were some mountaineers, like some really adept mountaineers, human mountaineers, who tried to replicate that route and could not do it, certainly not in that time frame and not at all. So they can go pretty much anywhere they want to go.
The Utah Division of Wildlife a couple years ago now actually captured and collared and released a wolverine. That was the first wolverine that had been actually sighted, as they say, in the state of Utah since 1979. So we know there's at least one, perhaps in wolverine in northern Utah. But like you say, it's probably not an established population. It's just kind of a migrant type of Wolverine or so on the move?
Yeah, so those juveniles, when they leave their parents' territories, they go for hundreds and hundreds of miles, and we see these solitary animals showing up in places where there hasn't been a documented wolverine population in a long time. And those animals are probably exploring from populations further to the north. There was a female wolverine that was killed on a highway in Utah, I think, as well, a few years ago. So we know there's a pretty straight shot from the population in Wyoming down through some pretty good dispersal habitat, mountain ranges, into Utah. So it's not surprising that they're going there, especially as the population continues to increase in Montana and Wyoming. You start to have more excess juveniles who are coming out of these reproductive population hoods in the various mountain ranges. And so I would not be surprised at all if more animals continue to show up in Utah.
And what do we know about their lifespan?
The maximum documented age of a wolverine in captivity is 15 years, I think. And we have a couple of examples from Scandinavia where wolverines live to about that age as well. So 15 years is what we're looking at for a full lifespan of a wolverine.
Last few minutes, let's circle back to the climate change topic. You said climate change is probably the biggest threat to their survival. I would throw in humans too, particularly farmers and ranchers who may also fear the introduction of wolverines, cattle or sheep herders, et cetera. But climate change, what is it about a warming world that's going to impact wolverine populations and survival?
Wolverines are highly evolved to live in cold and snowy environments. So everything from their very thick pelts, which are thermoneutral down to minus 40 degrees Celsius and Fahrenheit, it's the same. And those huge snowshoe feet that I referenced, the fact that snow provides an advantage for them for in getting food, whether it's killing animals or refrigerating a carcass. So a wolverine can feed on a carcass that's under snow, and it can come back to that carcass as it patrols its huge territory. It'll come back to that carcass multiple times and go down into the snow and feed on it and then come out and continue to patrol its territory. So, you know, there's that refrigeration aspect that those cold and snowy environments provide. Cold and snow exclude other predators, so there's less competition for the wolverine. It's able to really monopolize this cold and snowy niche. And then the mechanism that is most clearly defined in the scientific literature.
Recording stopped.
Sorry about that.
Oh, no, it's okay. Keep going.
Sorry, a little bit of an interruption there. But the mechanism that's most clearly defined in the lower 48 in the research is the fact that female wolverines give birth in these snow dens, which provide insulation and protection for their kits. There is a breakdown in that relationship if you go north of 55 degrees north latitude, but for the purposes of the lower 48, the fact that the female wolverine really depends on snow in order to provide this protection for her kits is a key component. And we know that snowpack is going to reduce significantly in the coming years. And that means that effectively the available habitat for wolverines is going to shrink. And the islands of habitat are going to become further and further apart because the snowpack is going to be reduced in size. So those animals that are dispersing are going to have to go further to get to a territory where they can set up their homes.
And we kind of touched on this in the very beginning, but what kind of protections do these wolverines have in Colorado and the surrounding states? Mm.
So their status on the Endangered Species Act prevents things like hunting, removal of the animals. It provides the sort of protections that I think we have created in an era when we could point to a very clear source of threat for a species. So you can't trap them, you can't hunt them, you can't do things in their habitat that's going to disturb the habitat and, reduce their ability to survive. However, there are specific exclusions around the Endangered Species Act that say that you cannot use it to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. So from my perspective, the Endangered Species Act is a great tool, but it hasn't come to the point where it's ready to address the threat of climate change to wildlife, which is going to be such a huge thing in the coming century. So it does provide protections, but it doesn't really address the source of the climate change issue.
Rebecca Waters, former executive director of the Wolverine Foundation. Rebecca, website for people to go to learn more about Wolverines and their work, and your work?
Yeah, you can visit wolverinefoundation.org, and we have a Facebook page as well. So check it out.
Thank you so much. Yes. So fascinating. I could talk to you for hours about this.
Thank you so much for hearing this.
We'll be in touch.
Okay.
When this release occurs, and circle back with you to get an update. So
that would be great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Rebecca.
And our next guest that is joining us is Anne Neville, and she joins us from the Nature Conservancy and going to be talking about some of the latest information that is happening with the Great Salt Lake and how the Nature Conservancy is getting involved with that and hopefully making some positive changes in the way of how much water we see in the Great Salt Lake. I was just out there not too long ago, and it was looking a little bit more promising than it was in a couple years past, mm-hmm. but we're still at a deficit, obviously a great deficit. So, Anne, thank you so much for joining us here on This Green Earth.
I'm honored to be here.
Well, let's start first with you. Mm-hmm. I'd like to know about your position with the Nature Conservancy and what you do there.
My position is called the Northern Mountains Regional Director, and we have divided the state up into three regional areas from a geological type of perspective. And so I have Northern Utah, which is the Bear River watershed, the Uintas, and Great Salt Lake.
Fantastic. And specifically, we're going to take the next couple minutes and talk about some of the things that are happening with the Great Salt Lake. And so can you give us kind of an overview update of where we are presently as far as the water table, what's happening there, and what some of those concerns are?
So I looked up this morning to see if I had the latest data on the Great Salt Lake Hydromapper, and we're sitting at an elevation of 4193.7, which is a little lower than our high of the year, which was around 4195. There's a couple of, you know, tenths of a foot in there that I don't know if they've agreed upon the exact high, which is really good because the low that we had in 22 was 4188.
Wow.
Yeah. So that is a big difference, and that covers many, many miles of shoreline. So that is really, really exciting. And for the ecological environment and of the lake, we're really pleased to have the microbialites covered again to help with the production of the brine shrimp and the brine flies.
So when you're talking about the microbialites, will you tell us what exactly that means?
I'm not the expert. There are many others out there that are, but how it's been explained to me is that the microbes are the diatoms and algae and bacteria, mm-hmm. And the light is the rock. And so as they metabolize these critters, these little single-celled small things, and now nematodes, they produce calcium carbonate, and so they make basically rocks. And so they're round, and they feel that they're a really important substrate for the brine flies to lay their eggs on. And then also they have enough nutrients that they sequester and release that the brine shrimp will go and hang out above them so that the algae that they eat will use those nutrients that the microbialites will be releasing. So it's pretty cool. And, you know, we haven't known this for all that long, relatively speaking, you know, maybe 10, 15 years. Maybe I only known it for 10, 15 years. Right. Maybe they've known it for a bit longer.
But But in any case, their presence helps establish a food chain that then, you know, like you say, provides a source of food to other phytoplankton, other maybe the brine shrimp, the brine fly, et cetera, within, which then is food source for birds and animals, et cetera. So it's an important element to the overall success of the ecosystem of the Great Salt Lake.
Yes, it is. And the other part of that process is the fact that as water goes through the wetlands and comes down from the mountains and comes through the wetlands, it's also creating habitat. So we have this multitude and really huge complementary ecosystem of the water going through the wetlands, as well as making the lake rise. And in the wetlands, we have, you know, fresher situations. We don't have the microbialites in the fresher, but we have a food web that is every bit as important and provides bugs, basically. Mm-hmm. You add water to a lot of the playas and the wetlands and you get bug soup, macroinvertebrates, and that is hugely important to the birds. So we need both.
So what is the role that the Nature Conservancy then is playing in helping to sustain these life forces?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we approach it as many different ways as we can, right? So we manage our own properties that protect Great Salt Lake environments. So we have about 10,000 acres in three different properties around the lake. Our one that is open to the public is the Great Salt Lake Shorelands Preserve.
Okay.
And that's around 4,000 acres. And basically what we want to do is, obviously, land use changes are happening all the time. You know, we're having a huge growth of development. And so how is that impacting our preserves? How is that impacting the birds using our preserves? And then how can we maximize the water and the habitats that we have so that we have as much habitat for the birds as possible? So one thing that I'm so impressed with our stewards, our land managers, we call them stewards. They have been thinking about ways that they can improve the properties that we own for a long time. Mm. And it's been funding and then the right type of designs that have been formulating for many, many years. And we have recently just finished one project called the Freeport Drain, where all the water, storm water, and any other, you know, sprinkler water or irrigation water that comes down through Layton and Syracuse gets all the way dumped onto our property through a drain. And so how could we clean that water up? How could we create more wetland habitat? And so we finished that last year, and this year was the first full year, and we're working with the University of Utah to measure the cleanliness of the water and the habitat and the soils, and then coming into these ponds, and then coming out also. We're also working with Utah Geological Survey that they're measuring groundwater. So we're seeing if that groundwater is being recharged by retaining that water longer than it having it go really quickly out, just straight out to the lake and not go into through the wetlands. And so we have two other projects that are almost ready to start construction that we're really excited about, called the Peregrine Pond and the Visitor Center Ponds. So, yeah, we're constantly trying to improve our properties.
Yeah, so 10,000 acres in total under the Nature Conservancy's purview, that's about 16 miles, square miles, plus or minus. Are there plans or efforts or opportunities to purchase more land?
Sure. It's tough, right? Because it has to be voluntary, and,
right.
And we want to make sure that that the people who are selling, and as development goes out, the property only gets more expensive. And
yeah.
So we're looking at a couple of different properties right now that we hope that we can use you know, matching funds with, you know, state dollars and federal dollars that we can purchase those properties. And I would love, you know, it's really, I would love to buy everything that's left. But we...
How much is that? I mean, a rough idea. Well, hundreds of thousands of acres or hundreds of square miles?
No, but it's basically, you know, if you look at a map, a lot of it is from the Antelope Island Causeway to the north is a lot of ag land.
Right.
Between here and Bear River Bay.
Yeah.
So, you know, we would love to be able to purchase that. But again, we don't want to stop agriculture.
Right.
So it has to be this synergy that we can develop, that we can protect the land, but also have the right amount of water and the right amount of staff that we can manage those properties.
And when you're talking about creating these centers and these visitor centers and these ponds, is it in the efforts of if you build this and bring people there and educate them that there will be more stewards in our future or people that are caring more? Why do you want to bring more people there?
Yeah, well, people really only care about the things that they understand and know. It's really hard. We have a culture, we had a culture, I feel like it's changed greatly, of people not caring about Great Salt Lake for a very long time. You know, when the pioneers settled here, they were desperate to stay alive, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so every little bit of water they wanted to use for farming or, you know, municipal use. And so they thought any water that got to the Great Salt Lake was horrible, was bad, it was wasted. And so that culture has lingered on and people have forgotten the bounty that Great Salt Lake really provides. And it provided food in cattails and waterfowl and stuff for pretty much basically saved pioneers the first couple of winters because there was things that they could use on the Great Salt Lake that the birds that were using it. And so that cultural change has been slow in coming, but I think that it is really there. So when they visit our site, they recognize, hey, I haven't been out here before. I haven't actually been to Great Salt Lake, or I only thought Great Salt Lake was, you know, the brine flies flying up and it was just too buggy.
Mm-hmm.
But when they come out to our site in the wetlands, they see this vast grassland and noise, the noise of the birds making all these wonderful sounds like the Wilson snipe using its wings to make a huffing sound that actually sounds really, really cool, mm-hmm. or a pheasant that is defending its territory, or the blackbirds defending their territory. And it's just lovely. And it's not very buggy. Now, everything's relative, and some people might think it's more buggy than it is, but it's pretty cool. And you have a boardwalk you can walk out. We have a tower you can look out, and you can see out to the Great Salt Lake. And it's just magical. And, you know, it's really important if we don't know about some things, we don't care about it. And then we also have this, our Wings and Water program, where we bring students out from all over the Wasatch Front. And we're book solid throughout the school year.
Oh.
People, the classrooms want to come, and we have scholarships available to provide buses so that the teachers don't have that worry.
Wow. Okay, so I know you just said your book, but where can people go to learn more about Wings and Water program or the other programs that you have?
So online, we have at nature.org/Utah, and then you can look up Great Salt Lake Shorelands Preserve. We also have a volunteer a coordinator. Her name is Andrea Nelson, and that is all online, and you can look that up. And if people can't find it, they can just contact nature.org and anything in there, and they can sign up through there. That will come straight to our coordinator.
All right. And Neville, the Northern...
Neville, actually.
Neville.
Oh,
like,
sorry.
Like Bonneville.
Bonneville, Neville. Okay. Northern Mountain Regional Director with the Nature Conservancy. Oh, I got that right.
Good job, Chris.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. And we hope to chat with you in the future.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
All Thanks, right. Anne.